What makes me an alcoholic is me not knowing how to stop once I put one in. And we'll get to that.
All right. This is the first time I'm doing this in English. You have reached En Beroende Pod, which is in English, an addiction podcast. And I'm in Palm Springs, outside LA, and I'm here on a 12-step convention. And yeah, as you know, my dear listeners, English is not my first language, so I'm a little bit nervous to do this in English, but I think it's polite of me to do it, so my guest feels included from the start.
Yes.
She is sitting right in front of me, and I came to Palm Springs yesterday, and I saw this lady on a meeting, and I thought that she said some very strong and wise stuff about this disease that we always talk about in this podcast and her life, and it inspired me to invite her to guest this podcast. And now she's here to tell us a little bit about her life and her recovery. And I'm truly grateful for this this meeting. And I will say warmly welcome to Jackie.
Hello, everybody. Hi, my name is Jackie, and I am an addict. My sobriety date is January 27, 2003, and I'm truly grateful for that. And when I say that word grateful, is that I'm learning to appreciate what is being given. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I'm the baby of three. I have two older brothers. I grew up in a household with two parents. But that does not make me an alcoholic. You know, where I grew up does not make me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is me not knowing how to stop once I put one in. And we'll get to that. But what I want to do is share just a little bit about my lifestyle, how I grew up, what I had to endure of growing up. Well, my brothers, they really didn't want a little sister. They wanted another brother. So they did everything they could to, you know, belittle me. They told me that I was found on the back porch, that my mom really felt sorry for me, that I didn't look like them. So I truly started to believe that, because my hair texture wasn't like theirs. My skin texture wasn't like theirs. So I started to believe that. Their hair was really, really curly. Their skin was really soft looking. They were born in Louisiana, and I was born here in California. So I did what I could to try to make them love me. They would, you know, we would play games together, and I would always let them win because I wanted them so much to love me. But to no avail, they still treated me like an outsider. So I would do what I could, too, to get them in trouble. You know, and so I told my mom one day that I just didn't want them to watch me anymore while she go to work. So she got my neighbor to watch me. And so my neighbor used to call me bad all the time. She told me that I was a bad girl. So she used to tie me up, like gag me with a scarf, and then tie me up, put my hands behind my back, tie my legs up, and put me in a closet every day, because she said that I was a bad girl. And she told me that she didn't understand why I couldn't be like my friend across the street.
How old were you?
I was like 5 years old at the time.
Oh my God.
You know, and so when she did let me out, you know, we would play around in the house. You know, we would run around the house, play hide and go seek or whatever. But her brothers, you know, they would fondle me, you know, as, you know, when I was little. And so I thought it was okay because I didn't know no better, you know, but I never told anybody. I never told my mom, my brothers or anything that they were putting their hands on me where they shouldn't have been putting their hands on me. But my family, on the other hand, my mom and my dad never got along really good. So my mama ended up leaving my dad. So I got away from all of that, which was probably the best thing that kind of like ever happened to me. Because never know what they would have done to me otherwise. They never did anything else to me, just touch me, right? So we moved away, and so I met my grandmother, who was this fireball. This lady, she has so much prestige. I loved her. She couldn't walk, but she was an alcoholic, as I could see now. She drank a lot. She drank gin and orange juice, and she carried a gun with her on the side of her. And so she one day took the gun and pointed it at me and told me that I will blow your head off if you don't listen to what I say. Now, I'm a young kid. I look at myself back then. I was one of those that didn't listen. You know, I was one of those who did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it.
Even though someone picked the bullet to your head.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I was one of those strong-willed kind of kids. You know what I'm saying? But when I, you know, going to school, kids were so cruel at school because they used to call me all kind of names. They used to call me Little Black Sambo, Nappy Headed, you know, all of that stuff. But the girls, the light-skinned girls at school, they the ones who had the boys. The boys would always be around them. They would never come around us like wanting to talk to us, like the dark-skinned girls. So we formed a gang at school. We called ourselves the Cisco Kids. So we robbed the kids for their lunch money and milk money. We were badass at school. You know what I mean? Like, we found ourselves the rebels of elementary school. Okay. It was something back then. But, you know, need to say that I got my fireness and all of that stuff, I got it from my mom and my grandmother because they didn't take no mess from nobody. You know, my mom was a fighter and my grandmother would shoot the shit out your ass if you just did something that she didn't like. And here I was in elementary school, you know, taking, you know, kids' lunch money and milk money. So I was a bully. I didn't see it that way, but I actually was, you know. So then once I graduated from elementary school, I go to junior high school and I carry myself as, you know, this prestige girl, you know, who I thought that I had arrived because, you know, I was a beautiful black girl who just felt like she was in her own little world. I had makeup on and I would dress in the prettiest clothes. And I seen this teacher who really liked me. And I really liked him. And so we had an affair, you know? And so I started smoking weed and drinking in junior high school. You know, I would watch my brothers and my mom them roll up weed and, you know, they would be drinking and having parties at the house and stuff. And I would sneak. And
junior high, you're like 13 here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm smoking weed and I'm drinking, but I'm sneaking. They don't know I'm doing it. But then I got caught at school smoking cigarettes. And so then my mom tells me, well, you know what? If you really want to smoke cigarettes, then you need to smoke cigarettes at home. So now she's giving me permission to do things at home. So now I can do a little bit of something. She let me, like, on special occasions, like Christmas and stuff like that, have a little drink. But while she's saying all of that, I'm already sipping and drinking at home. So I'm sneaking and doing all of this stuff. So I have a boyfriend that she didn't know I had. I'm just really doing some sneaky stuff, right? So they having their parties and stuff like that. And so when she have her parties, I'm doing the one who's mixing drinks for her friends, right? So I'm over here mixing drinks and I'm sipping the drinks and making sure that they taste good for the people, right? And I'm feeling kind of dizzy, you know, just making drinks for them. But I didn't, back then, when I look at it, something was wrong with me back then because I was just outright wild, you know? So that doesn't make me an alcoholic either back then. I was just being defiant and being a brat. You know, but as I grew up, you know, I did a lot of mischievous things. You know, I got pregnant at an early age. I was 16. She didn't let me keep the baby. She made me get rid of the baby. I hated my mom for that, though. Really, I did, because I know that I really wanted that baby. I believed that that baby was going to do something for my insides to make me happy. But she didn't let me keep it. And that was a hole that stayed inside of me for many years. You know what I'm saying? And so I believe that that was a contributing factor to me drinking more and then, you know, exploring more drugs, because then I was taking black mollies. I was smoking weed more, and then I started snorting cocaine. And that was when I was in high school. And so I believe I crossed the line then. That's when I believe that my addiction really, really took off. My oldest brother had gotten murdered. That was another factor of why I just kind of like didn't want to live anymore. I wanted to just get high and drink and just do nothing. I didn't even want to graduate from high school, you know. And so I just got high and I drank every day. But once I hit that pipe of cocaine in 1982, that turned my whole world around. I didn't believe that little white pebble thing would turn me into a monster. It really did. It took a lot of my insecurity away. It took a lot of my self-esteem away. It made me do things that I really wouldn't have done had, you know, I not been under the influence of that rock cocaine. And this was early when I first started using it. You know, I was selling stuff, you know, early on. I was blown away how it just turned my whole world around. And so I never did get any treatment, but then I started having a lot of babies. And so I was smoking and being pregnant. And that right there was another factor that, you know, I wanted to stop when I got pregnant, but I couldn't. The disease was so on me, so powerful on me, that I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. And then when I stopped, I always would start back, you know. And so the Department of Children and Family Services came into my life so many times, you know, wanting to take my children away from me because of, you know, lack of being able to take care of my children, you know, or being under the influence of my children being born under the influence of crack cocaine and alcohol and marijuana, you know, and stuff like that. Not being able to take care of my children, feed my children, just me being out there in the streets doing whatever I had to do to get the next hit, you know. And it was very demoralizing, you know. And so what happened was one day I went to jail, and so I was so tired of myself and so tired of, you know, looking at what I had become. I had become this monster of a woman who just didn't care about nothing. I couldn't care about my kids. And thank God for my mom My mom stepped in and took care of all my kids. I had six kids. And she came in and stepped in and took care of my children, you know. But in that sense, I was in and out of jail, you know, for prostitution, substance. They would catch me with, you know, rock cocaine on me, or I would be coming from a rock house, you know, and they would stop me and I would go to jail. And so the last time I went to jail, they wanted to give me 9 years of prison. And I was okay with going to prison, you know, because it was like it would have been better than being under the influence. I think my thinking was, okay, look, if I go to prison, then I would be separated from the drug. But then knowing that once I go to prison, there's drugs in prison. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know. It was just like I wanted to go to prison. I felt like I wanted to go where the big girls was at. You know what I'm saying? Because I felt like that was a better place for me to go. And then what happened was they didn't send me to prison because of a proposition they had here in California, which was Prop 36. So they gave me Prop 36 and they was telling me that Prop 36 was a proposition for if anybody got that proposition, they would be able to go back to treatment and, you know, be able to get treatment. And hopefully that this treatment would take account of, and then you can, you know, be able to get some help and, you know, probably be able to live your life, you know. But I didn't know if this treatment was going to help me because I was the real one. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was the one who would steal from my mama. I stole from my kids. I stole their school clothes.
So you get to choose between prison and rehab.
Yes. Yeah. So I was like, okay, they told me that I was eligible for it. So I went on and took the treatment, you know. And so, but I didn't know if it was going to work or not. You know, I just didn't know. But I chose it, you know. And so, and that was God-given. I really do believe in my heart that that was God-given because I could have just went on and said, no, I'm just going to go on to prison, you know. And so I went to treatment, you know. And so something, God came to me and he said to me, it was so clear that he needed me to help him with his people. And I was like, what? Like help with his people? Like, I didn't understand it at first, you know. And so when I got the treatment, then I kind of like started to understand because there was a lot of women that was coming into the treatment facility that were younger than me because I was the oldest one in there. I was 41 and all these other women were coming in there. They were 25 and like, you know, under my age, you know, and these young girls were starting to call me mama, you know, and they felt so good that I was giving them direction. And so it started to make sense that I was helping them to get some stability in their life, like they were my children. And so I just kept on and I stayed in that treatment facility for 15 months. I completed the program and then I went to sober living. And I stayed there and I got a sponsor. And I start doing the work and then I start being of service in the program, you know, and I started taking on commitments and, you know, like being a treasurer and a secretary. And then everything started to just open up. And then I went home to my children and I started to be a mom to them, you know, taking some of the pressure off of my mother.
You know, how was that, you know, going into the mother role from where you came from?
Ooh, it was difficult and it was scary because the personalities of my children, it was six personalities that I had to deal with. with my children. Like, some of them was glad for me to come home, and then there was a couple of them that was like, okay, you home, and what? You ain't been here all this time. How you gonna come here and start trying to tell somebody what to do? So I had to deal with those attitudes and behaviors. But the one thing about it is that I stood my ground, though. You know, I'm your mom, no matter what you think, you know, but I had to take it real slow, you know. And I still was getting, like, some therapy on the side, too. And I took them to therapy.
And build up the trust again.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so my oldest son was telling me, he said, well, Mom, he said, when I know you're okay, he said, I'm going to move out. Because he was helping my mom with the kids, right? My oldest, right? And in my mind, I'm like, well, how do you know I'm going to be all right? How do you know? You know, and so he moved out. I was 2 years sober when he moved out. And so it just kind of like behooved me, like he seen me like really doing a lot in the program, a lot in the fellowship. He seen my attitude and my behavior change. He seen when I said I was going to do something that I did it.
But it took him 2 years to believe that it was real.
He took him 2 years to believe that. You know what I'm saying? He seen the confidence in me that, you know, yeah, she's going to be okay, you know. And even to this day, you know, my kids, they just like, Mom, we are so proud of you. You're like, you know, they tell me this, like, every year that I turn a year sober, they want to give me my cake, you know, or they'll call me or send me a card or saying, you know, we can't believe, Mom, that you have made it another year. Like, and the beautiful thing of it is that they trust me. Like, they trust me with their, like, if they got something going on that they need to talk to me about, and they talk to me about anything, if they going through some health issues or some girl issues, man issues, they call and they talk to their mom about it. And that right there just blows me away, because I never thought that they would want to talk to me about any of that stuff, you know, because before my mom passed away, they used to call and talk to her mostly.
And when was that?
My mom passed away in 2018. And that was a devastating thing for all of us, especially my children, because she was the one who really raised them. You know, while I was getting clean, you know, she was the one who just loved on them, took care of them, fed them, and did all of this stuff. And it took a real toll on them, you know. But me and my husband, we took care of my mom until she passed away. She died in our house. You know what I mean? And
did you feel that you had to step up even more when she passed away?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I had to really, really show them that, you know, now that, you know, your granny is not here, I had to let them know that I am mom 100% now, you know, because they still, even though my mom was not being, you know, it's like she wasn't walking, they still was going to her. You know, for some things, but I knew that once she passed away, I had to be 100% with them and for them, you know. And so now we all get together, like, you know, at least once a month and have game day at my house. Or, you know, it's just the relationship I have with them, I can't even put words to it. It's just so freaking beautiful. You know, my recovery means a whole lot to me. They know that. They know that my recovery comes first. My God comes first. You know, then it's my immediate family, like my husband, and then it's them. they know, you know. Like, me and my husband, we adopted my grandson, one of my grandkids, and we've raised him from an infant to a young man. He's about to be 18 years old.
It's like you get a new chance to do something right.
Yes. Yeah. We got a new chance to be a better parents, you know, because my husband has children, too, you know, that he wasn't a part of their lives because of his addiction, too. And now he got to be a better parent as well with the hands on, because his kids live out of town. So he was around my kids a lot that he was hands on with. You know, and then the grandkids, he was hands-on with. You know what I'm saying? So he got to be a better parent, too.
Was this hurtful for you that your kids considered your mom like their mom? Or you just feel like you're grateful for her existence?
No, I was so grateful that she took them in.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have no ill feelings about that at all. And the one good thing about it is that my kids wasn't separated. All six of my kids was in the house with her. That was a grateful thing, is that I'm so glad that they wasn't separated. Because they needed each other so much. You know, each one taught, like my oldest son was kind of like, you know, he's the big brother. And so I have four boys and I have two girls, you know, and my oldest son kind of like really fathered those boys, you know. And so my mom, like, you know, she really took care of those girls, you know what I'm saying? Their personal stuff, you know what I'm saying? And my sons took care of them boys, you know what I'm saying? Told them about their hygienes. And, you know, he just did a whole lot for them. And even to this day, you know, they really appreciate their brother for all of that. You know, and right now they have a group chat that they just brotherly talk to each other every day. And it just warms my heart that they're so close to each other. And you know what I'm saying? Like, one of my sons got married last year and they all got together and just loved on each other. You know what I'm saying? So that's what just warms me, is that they all are so close. All of my kids are so close to each other. I'm sorry, but I'm just so overwhelmed of my family, how we were so separated, and now that we're so, so close to each other, we just love on each other all the time. And that's the beauty of this fellowship, and this is what this fellowship has done for me and, you know, my recovery process and what I do is that the family afterward. That's a part of the family afterward, which is in the book. You know, how I have become a strong alcoholic addict, you know, and then my children have become stronger, too, because they see me. You know, in the strong sense, I came back. I got a job. As a matter of fact, I was working two jobs. You know what I'm saying? And then I went and got my degree to be an alcohol and drug counselor. You know what I'm saying? And then I met this man here in the rooms of recovery. You know what I'm saying? And then we got married. You know, like, it was just so beautiful. Things just kind of like fell into place. And look at us now. We got this young man who just graduated high school. He's going on to college. And now it's about me and him having our way in our life. Now we are getting ready to go on a cruise. We're getting ready to enjoy our life now, because we've definitely set sail the idea of raising this young man to be a young man. And now he's off to his college days. And now we finna live our life.
This is your grandson, right?
Yes.
Yes. It's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing. Which part of recovery has been the most challenging for you?
Well, I'll say keeping a sponsor, because some of the sponsors that I've had, they've been like, seem like they've been saying that they're intimidated by my recovery because I'm always out here doing stuff, you know, and some of these sponsors that I've had, they've been kind of like kicked back. They really don't do a lot. I'm always into service. I am always into service. I do panels. I've spoken at this convention. Like, yeah, I speak all over. Like, people have asked me to speak a lot, you know what I mean?
And I asked you to come to this podcast.
Yes, and you asked me to come to this podcast.
I did.
Yes. And so that's where my most challenging is that me and a lot of my sponsors kind of like we bump heads is because they really be intimidated by my recovery. And I'm like, you're sponsoring me, like, but we in this together. So a lot of them kind of like back off of me, you know, and that's why I don't keep a sponsors, because they say I intimidate them. I don't understand that, but I don't know.
Have you been close to relapse anytime? It's because it's 20 years, right? It's a long time.
20
years, yeah.
I haven't been close to relapse, but I have been close to suicide a few times where I just wanted to end my life because of the challenges of life, not because I wanted to drink or I wanted to use. It's just some life situations showed up where I just couldn't deal with it, so I had to go get some outside help. And thank God that I did. And thank God that my husband has just been such a pillar in my life and been, you know, really supporting me, you know, and I really appreciate him, because the last time that I wanted to commit suicide was last year. And we were really going through a lot of family stuff. And I called him and I told him, like, you know, I said, I just don't want to be here no more. And I immediately called my therapist, and then I called my psychiatrist, and they immediately gave me they changed my meds. And it was my medication that really had me, like, lopsided. So that's why they said that's why I was off. My medication was the reason why I was lopsided and I wanted to commit suicide, because I didn't have the right medication.
Hmm. Pretty impressive, though, that you were sober all through this.
Yes.
That says something about how strong your recovery is.
Yeah, that's what they say. I mean, but you know what? But I believe that that's because I got God on my side. And see, God has given me an assignment. When he asked me to help him with his people, he got me sober because he wanted me to help with the fellowship. He wanted me to help, you know, get more people into this fellowship, you know, to guide and to be there to sponsor others. You know what I mean? So God has already been right here with me, even through those situations that I've had. God has got me. And I believe that wholeheartedly, because he's not ready for me to go yet. Mm. I have work to do for God. Mm. I really do believe that in my heart. Mm. That's who got me here.
And now you get the chance to help the Swedish addicts as well.
Oh, yes, yes. I definitely want to help people all over the world. I have some friends in Canada that I have met on Zoom, and we are the best of the best of friends. And, you know, man, I'm so glad that I met them. You know, I met them on Zoom like 3 years ago. And so I talk to them on a daily on a daily, on this meeting that I am on in the morning. And it's called the Moreno Valley Group. And so I'm spreading myself all over. Wherever I can be to help somebody, that is where I want to be. And so I'm in the helping business.
A lot of our listeners is mothers that have kids that are addicts, and they feel powerless and sad, of course. And I have no idea how it is with your children, but this is a family disease that affects anyone in the family, and it is genetic. How should you act if you are a parent with kids who are in this disease? Is there anything to do? You set boundaries, or how do you do to not be a codependent? And do you have any advice for this?
Oh, well, yes. I have. Okay, so when I got sober, you know, I have a son who was really acting out really bad, you know, and I did all that I could to keep the rest of my family, you know, intact, you know what I mean? And so what I had to do is I had to remove him from my family. Mm. You know, he went to go live with his dad, and I didn't feel bad about it at all, because I was in the midst of adopting my grandson. He was disrupting the household, and I put him out. Mm-hmm. I really did. And you know what? He had called the police on me. And so DCFS had came because he had told them that I was jumping on him. And I never put my hands on him. You know, I wanted to, but I didn't. But I put him out. And he was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And he never moved back to my house ever again. And me and him is close, just like this today. Mm. You know what I mean? But my thing is that I had to set some boundaries.
You did it to protect the others.
So. I had to.
Yeah.
And I had to set some boundaries and let him know that he was not going to disrupt the household, because we was trying to set boundaries in the house of, because I was like I said, I was in the middle of adoption. I wouldn't let nothing mess with that. And then my other kids, we was trying to build some boundaries with them too. And he was just, oh man, he was doing everything he could. He was coming in the house late. He was smoking weed. He was doing all that he could. And I just, for me not to put my hands on him, the best thing I could have did was told him that he had to leave. Mm-hmm. And it hurted me real bad. But then he went with his dad. And that was the best thing for him. And it was okay. I mean, he was very angry at first, you know, at me. But then, you know what? He'll tell you today that was the best thing that ever happened to him. And we have a really, really great relationship today.
Yeah, that's interesting that what you're saying, because all the people that set boundaries for you when you were in your disease, I was so angry at them. I hated them.
Right.
I remember when my daddy wouldn't let me come to his birthday party because I was like a mess. Mm-hmm. And I hated him. How could he do that? I'm his son. But today, I'm grateful for those boundaries.
Right, yeah. Right. And we need those.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
need those. And then we need to give others boundaries too.
Yeah, yeah.
For not only for us, but for them. Mm-hmm. Because we need to let them know that, you know, today we're standing for something, we're not falling for anything. Mm. You know what I mean? So I'm grateful that I did that. And even with my daughter, who, my youngest daughter, you know, me and her, we have a relationship, but not a relationship that I really want. You know, she's really not happy with me, because she really won't tell me why, but we have a strange relationship. You know, I don't talk to her a lot. You know, she's the one who I have her son. I adopted her son, but I love her. And I hope one day that, you know, she comes clean and talk to me about, you know, why she's so distant from me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she don't call. I mean, it might go about 3 months I don't talk to her. And I'll be worried about her. She lives in Texas. So, I don't know. But I call her. I leave her messages. I text her, you know, just to see if she's okay, you know. But she has her life to live. She's 32.
Yeah, maybe she has her journey to do, you know.
Yes. 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 And I just want to make sure that she knows that no matter what, that I love her.
And you'll be here when she's ready to talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I already told her, if you want to do therapy, we can do therapy together. Mm. You know? Because it's probably something that, you know, we probably, you know, something in her childhood that she wasn't happy about. But if she wants to, fine. If she doesn't, fine. But, you know.
That's all we can do.
That's all we can do.
Step 8 and 9.
Yep.
Yep. Can't do anything more than that. But a lot of our listeners has this picture of sobriety that and this fears that it's going to be empty, boring, a gray life. And, you know, what can you say to these people?
Oh, my God. I have so much fun. Oh, my God. I'm doing so much. I go to comedy shows, dances. Me and my husband, we do so much together. Like, even at home, this is what. We have our own karaoke machine. We sing to each other. We dance with each other at home.
And now he's sitting in the couch here. Yes. Nodding his head.
Yes.
Yes, we dance. Yes.
Yes. I mean, we don't have to, like, we play games together. Like, we're such love to each other.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we take a drive together to the beach. We live, like, 10 minutes from the beach. We'll go down to the beach together. Life is good. I mean, I couldn't express. Being in recovery has put me in a very, very different perspective on what fun is. Like, I don't have to go anywhere. Me and my husband, we would sit here. We would sit at home and with no TV on, just listening to some music. I might be in the kitchen cooking some dinner or whatever, and then I might go over there and say, hey, babe, come on, get up and let's dance together. We might slow dance together. We do a whole lot.
Yeah, and the thing, that's something good that you're saying there, because the mind, the perspective changes. What you think is fun changes.
Yes.
I'm still a guy that hates a boring day. I can't stand having a boring day. I love to have a good day with fun stuff and, you know, nice meetings and do stuff.
Yes.
And that hasn't changed. But what I like to do has changed. What I think is fun has changed.
Right. Right. So are you going to be dancing tonight?
If you invite me for a dance.
Oh,
Is that okay with husband?
Yes.
It's okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yes. I dance. Yeah.
You know what? Let me tell you something. There's so much to do in recovery. You know, I mean, we have so much to do is that we have to think outside the box because we've been in a box for so long. We have to get out. And I mean, even, you know, with my husband, I remember him used to say, oh, I'm so bored. And I'm like, come on, think of something to do. We don't have to spend no money. That's fine. We got so many games because I'm a game person. I love to play games. So we got so many games at home. Like, come on, let's get in a game or something and do something. I'm a football fan. He's a football fan. You know, I'm a basketball fan. So we love wrestling. You know what I'm saying? So it don't take much for me to be happy. You know, so I'm really happy with this guy.
And he's happy too, I think.
Yeah, I love him.
Ja, nu ska vi koppla in vännerna från The House Rehab för att svara på en lyssnarfråga.
Okej, då har jag fått sällskap här i studion av Robert Boman och Anna Cetreus från The House Rehab. Välkomna hit.
Tack så mycket.
Tack, hej Nemo.
Hej på er, hur mår ni? Hur var fint?
Ja, jag mår bra.
Hur svarade jag?
Kul att vara här. Ja, precis.
Mm. Ni är så i syng, så ni svarar åt varandra.
Ja.
Underbart ju. Vi ska svara på en lyssnarfråga. Är ni redo för det?
Det är vi.
Absolut.
Bra, då kör vi tycker jag. Och veckans fråga lyder så här. Hej på er, tack för en fantastisk podd. Jag har en fråga som jag har tänkt på länge. Varför har ni bara gäster som har lite längre nykterhet i ryggen? Varför inte gäster som är mitt i sin process eller nynyktra?
Jättebra fråga. Ja, och det handlar ju faktiskt om personen själv. Ja, när man är i början av sin process så tycker vi att man ska få vara i fred i den. Inte bli störd i den och heller inte i efterhand kunna känna sig använd eller utnyttjad. Det kan vara så att man... är väldigt känslomässig, tidigt tillfrisknande. Man kanske går ut med eller säger saker som man i efterhand inte alls känner att jag hade velat berätta. Så det handlar ju faktiskt främst om respekt för klienten och klienten eller personen och personens tillfrisknande. Våra klienter är aldrig med här.
Nej. Nej. Och det här hänger väl lite också ihop med den kritiken du tidigare uttryckte för programmet Behandlingen på Kanal 5, antar jag.
Ja.
Ja.
Absolut, och sen så är det ju också så att jag menar att vi har ju ett ansvar också. Vi vill inte bjuda in en nynykter person bara för att den kanske är ett offentligt namn. Och sen mår den här personen fruktansvärt dåligt eller återfaller om en vecka. Och här har vi ett medmänskligt ansvar helt enkelt. Och det vore både etiskt och oetiskt och omoraliskt att bjuda in någon med kort nykterhet.
Mm. Ja, bra svar. Och om man vill nå er på The House Rehab, vart vänder man sig då?
Då går det bra att mejla till sandra@thehouserehab.com eller till alicia@thehouserehab.com.
Och ni har också ett telefonnummer som finns på er hemsida, tror jag.
Det stämmer. Yes.
Toppen. Tack för att ni kom förbi.
Tack.
Tack.
Hoppas du som ställer frågan är nöjd med ditt svar. Och tack till The House för att ni var med i den här podden också. Ni är fantastiska. Yes, I'm sitting here with Jackie, and we have talked a bit about her story. And I came to Palm Springs, I think it was yesterday or maybe 2 days ago. I'm not sure, I'm so jet lagged, I can't think.
Wednesday?
But thanks, I was so nervous to come here because this is my first time in USA. And I've never been to this like big international convention. But when I came here... And the amazing thing about these conventions is like there's so much love in the air and there's nothing to be nervous about. Everyone is so welcoming here and take care of you and talk to you. And even though I haven't met you guys before ever, I feel like you're my friends in like 1 second. Mm-hmm. And that's magic. Mm-hmm. You can't experience that anywhere else in the world. That's unique. And I'm so grateful for that. And I just want to say that, aside of that you being on my podcast, I just want to say thank you for being so kind and welcoming.
You're welcome.
How did you find out about the convention here?
Thing is, I always look on the CAA website just to, because I have been to conventions in Sweden, in Denmark, and some meetings in England as well. Great Britain, but I've never been to USA, and I heard so much about the meetings in USA.
Okay.
Because you people can talk. You have this theater. What do you think? Almost theatrical. What do you think? Theatralic.
Yeah. Theatric.
Theatric.
Yeah.
It's so big, and you so much. It's charisma, and that's a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm so happy that I finally get some international guests in this podcast, because my listeners in Sweden need to hear these stories as well. So thank you so much, Jackie, for taking time to.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And I'm looking forward to tonight to dance with you.
Okay. Sounds fun to me. We're going to have a good time. And they're going to be karaokeing later on, too, tonight.
Oh, now we're talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are.
Mm-hmm.
And thank...
Probably get down like ABBA.
ABBA. Yeah, maybe. If they have some ABBA songs, I will do it. Yeah. Count on me.
And thanks to all the listeners in Sweden. We are so proud that we are Sweden's biggest podcast about addiction. And we are so proud that this podcast keeps helping people all around Sweden. So thank you for listening. And thank you, Jackie, for taking your time.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. Much love to you.
Much love to you and your amazing husband. And to CA USA. And we'll talk next time, next Wednesday. Bye-bye.